Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. When we set about the job of protecting the country we love, it is always a privilege, as well as really a necessity, to take stock and counsel with our friend Sam Faddis, who has his finger on the pulse of developments both foreign and domestic, and we want to talk with him about several of those in the course of the next two segments. Sam, of course, brings to these kinds of conversations, which he privileges us by having with him each week, a wealth of experience as an Army officer, as a undercover operative for the Central Intelligence Agency for some 20 years, as an assistant attorney general in the state of Washington, as well as these days as a very astute commentator and analyst on the matters of the day that he places at andmagazine.com at Substack. He's also the author, among other things, of Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA. Sam Faddis, it's so good to have you with us as always. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Frank. Always great to be here.
I wanted to start by asking you to comment on a subject that we addressed yesterday in our Committee on the Present Danger China webinar. We do these each week. You are very generous with your time in contributing to many of them. This one focused on, well, an effort that is underway, I think stealthily at the moment, by the Biden administration and other old friends of China, as the Chinese Communist Party calls them, who are beavering away at trying to spare the Chinese Communist Party the consequences of terrible decisions and myriad structural problems that could portend the demise of the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, possibly in the not too distant future, unless they are bailed out by, well, us, probably mostly. Sam, you had a marvelous meme that you attached to a recent column at End Magazine at Substack, and I just wanted Justin to throw it up here as we're talking. It speaks to the issue of why Joe Biden would be frantically trying to help his Chinese friends, as well as really others in the captured elite in this country. But talk a little bit about the advisability, as you see it, strategically, to say nothing of economically, financially, you know, politically, of bailing out the CCP at such a moment as this.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it? I mean, we've talked so many times about the fact that we pump money, have pumped money into the CCP. We have built the dragon. We have made it bigger and more ferocious and created this enemy that now literally threatens us and seeks to supplant us. And now we find that because of their grotesque mismanagement and all the inherent problems with a state-controlled economy, etc., they appear to be headed for the cliff. And we ought to be letting them go over the cliff, and instead their minions, starting at the very top, you know, with the Manchurian president, now apparently want us to save them. So not bad enough. We built the beast. Now we're going to save the beast from its fate, so I guess it can continue its mission of trying to kill us. It's mad.
It is. And one of the most interesting pieces of this webinar, and it's available for free, folks, at presentdangerchina.org. I commend all of the webinars, including the many that Sam has been in, but all of them to you. But this is a particularly timely and important one. And Sam, what I found fascinating was this isn't the first time we've bailed these guys out. In fact, you could argue that, you know, our help to Mao Zedong when he was fighting Chiang Kai-shek, Chiang Kai-shek in the Chinese Revolution was instrumental in enabling the beast, as you say, to get up and running in the first place. It's madness, yes, but I wonder if it's not also treason.
Well, it is. It is. I mean, this is not incompetence, right? This is not negligence. This is not just a bunch of guys who don't know what they're doing. This is all very deliberate because they have switched sides. Because from the president, so-called, on down, they're playing for the other team. I always like to juxtapose this with Reagan and the Soviet Union, and or just in general, our policy. Can you imagine the Soviet Union beginning to disintegrate, its economy falling apart, the end of the Cold War is nigh, and the U.S. government would step in to help the USSR paste itself back together? That's what we're talking about here.
Yeah, you know, I think actually having served through part of that period, there is some evidence that people were actually trying to save the Soviet Union before it fell. But fortunately, I think the success of the Reagan strategy was such that they simply couldn't pull it off. But you're right, Sam. Think about how different the world would be if we had, the Germans and others, been able to prop up Gorbachev and his ilk and maintain the evil empire by so doing. We must not make that mistake now against a vastly more dangerous foe. And our Committee on the Present Danger is on the case, and we look forward to working with you to try to make the argument that at the very, very minimum, this must be the subject of a national debate, not simply something that's, as I say, sub rosa, perpetrated by people who I think are betraying their country, including the President of the United States. Sam, I wanted to turn to another President of the United States, now former President, Donald Trump. After he was booked for a racketeering conspiracy charge, among others, in Atlanta yesterday, he was heard to say that what this whole thing, this particular set of indictments and the other three, amount to is really election interference. To your great credit, you have spent a lot of time of late on election integrity, trying to make sure that we have a free and fair ballot the next time around, and in your native Pennsylvania in particular, but I think nationally as well. Is that a fair characterization of what's actually afoot here, do you think?
Without question. I mean, look, there was massive interference in the 2020 election. And I'm not just talking about voting machines and voting rolls, which are real, real issues. But you think about the smearing of Donald Trump, the burying of the laptop. I mean, all the interference of the government with social media and forbidding people from even knowing certain things. Incredible interference to skew this thing toward Biden. Again, before we get to all the issues, I'm not saying the others don't exist. Now we're seeing this again. I mean, these people who are terrified, obviously, of going to the polling place, of election day coming and having to run against Donald Trump. Why? Because the country is furious. It would be hard to overstate how angry the American people are. So
hold the thought, Sam, because we have to take a short break. I want to see what you think about how reliably that anger can be translated into a course correction if we haven't actually fixed some of the things that were problematic in the last election cycle. We'll be right back with more right after this. Stay tuned.
This
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. As the Chinese Communist Party's friends in the Biden administration and on Wall Street mount a stealthy campaign to prop up that mortal enemy, a formidable opponent has emerged in Congress. Fortunately, Representative Mike Gallagher can do more than simply raise an alarm about this covert effort to stave off, with U.S. taxpayers and investors' funds, China's intensifying economic crisis and the political one it is precipitating. As chairman of the House Select Committee on the CCP, he can help stop it. In a powerful interview last week, he declared, quote, "Reasonable people can disagree about where exactly you draw the line for economic decoupling from China, but no one, Republican or Democrat, would think that we should be allowing American money to invest in its most dangerous companies. In some meaningful and very troubling sense, we are subsidizing our own destruction," unquote. Amen. This is Frank Affney.
We're back, and we are continuing our conversation with the great Sam Faddis. We're talking about election integrity, something that Sam has been seized with since the unpleasantness, shall we say, of 2020. And I was just asking about, despite your best efforts and that of many, many others, Sam, it appears as though in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, among other places, we've not really fixed some of the things that contributed to, a lack of election integrity in 2020. And what is now, it appears, looming once again is the purported necessity of responding to another pandemic, among other things, by once again, wait for it, generating mail-in ballots. Remind us about our experience with them the last time and the inadvisability of going down that road again.
Well, I think what people need to understand about this concept of mass market mail-in ballots, as I say, as distinct from limited categories of absentee ballots, which nobody's trying to get rid of, is that we rushed into this. And everybody, well, not everybody, but a lot of people want to sort of presume that there are all sorts of safeguards. Those safeguards don't exist. There are giant gaping holes in the security of this system. There are lots of people on the voter rolls that either don't exist, left the state, whatever. There are all kinds of issues with knowing under what circumstances the ballot was cast, who really cast the ballot. We could just go on down this list. And the short version is, we're getting ready to go into the next presidential election in the state of Pennsylvania, and it is an example of what's going on nationwide. And we have basically fixed none of those. We haven't done anything, despite massive pressure to do this. The legislature really hasn't fixed any of it. So we're going to run another election using that same system and, I guess, hope for something else.
The question occurs, Sam, and it's my understanding that Republicans are in charge of the legislature in Pennsylvania, or at least have been for much of this period. Why is it that they are not taking the lead in making obviously necessary correctives?
Well, in Pennsylvania, and again, think Pennsylvania is a good, it is not unique. It's an example of what's going on across the country. There's not just a gap between the base in the Republican Party and the leadership. There's a Grand Canyon between the base and the leadership. I mean, when Doug Mastriano was the gubernatorial candidate last time around, who was very much a MAGA guy, America First guy, and didn't have the party leadership behind him, not only did the party walk away from him, but some very powerful, influential people showed up to funnel money to his Democratic opponent with this idea that we'd rather have a Democrat in Harrisburg than have a guy who the people actually chose as a candidate.
And these are prominent Republican donors, among others?
Yeah, we ended up with a Republicans for Shapiro being the gubernatorial candidate, PAC, funded with ungodly sums of money. That's the perfect word to describe it, to make sure a Democrat ends up in the governor's mansion in Harrisburg, not a guy that people chose.
This is terrifying, I have to say, because so much is riding. I don't need to impress that upon you, and I think probably on our audience, on having the opportunity for the American people to express their urgent need for a course correction. And if they're denied that, I really fear for the future of our republic, not just because of what will be elected in its stead, but also because of the alienation that is in the offing. And Sam, maybe I can ask you to tease this out with me. One of the things that is particularly concerning to me is something that Tucker Carlson actually asked Donald Trump about in the course of their now quite celebrated interview that completely overshadowed the Republican primary debate. And that is there a civil war in the offing? And I've been worrying about this, I think you have probably for some time too, but you look at the myriad things that the Biden administration is doing that seem calculated to provoke, you know, a reaction. Well, yes, but possibly out of sheer frustration at some point, even a violent reaction. And in fairness, some of it's not literally the Biden administration, but its team. As an example, and this just, my head exploded when I saw this the other day. There are 14 cities in the United States, including Washington, D.C., that have embraced a climate change agenda that commits them by 2030 to eliminate the consumption of meat and dairy products and the ownership of private vehicles in those 14 cities. Now, is that going to happen? I tend to doubt it, but do you think that the American people will actually take that lying down? I doubt it. But is there, I mean, you've run operations for our country overseas. Is that an op, would you say?
Well, it certainly feels like one. And I could say this definitively from my sense of traveling around the state of Pennsylvania all the time and talking to people in groups all over the place. The American people are being pushed and pushed and pushed, and the quality of life is collapsing, and their government ignores them and is pursuing policies that I think are deliberately designed to attack them, to destroy their quality of life, to tear down our whole society. And I am worried, as I think it was clear that President Trump was very worried. Where does this take you? How far do you think you can push people? Or as you suggest, are you deliberately trying to push people to the point where they feel like I have got no recourse? And that's horrifying.
No, it is. And Sam, one other aspect of this, which I also find horrifying, you've served in uniform. I think we've talked about this particular development in the past, but just to put it into this context, the president has nominated as the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff a man who believes that this country is systemically racist and that our military must now be indoctrinated against that, and that, you know, promotion should be on the basis, apparently, of diversity considerations. And I assume that means, their ideological lineup as well as their, you know, physical characteristics. And I just wonder, when you look at not only what a wrecking operation he's done, this is a general by the name of C.Q. Brown, to the U.S. Air Force in his right. 3.5 years or so of service there, right, as chief of staff. Is this about preparing for the weaponization of the United States military in maybe even preemptive action against Americans upset for the kinds of reasons you've just described?
Well, it's certainly consistent with that idea, isn't it? I mean, it's also, at a minimum, destroying the nation's greatest meritocracy, right? As I've said many times, it sickens me, this idea that we're tribalizing the military and want Marines and airmen and soldiers to look at each other and not see fellow Americans, but a white guy, a black guy, an Asian guy, a straight guy.
And a guy who's benefiting from being one of those things or being punished for being one of those things. Yep. No, it's goes back to what we've talked about many times. I think it is a wrecking operation against our country, and we have to hold accountable the people who are perpetrating it, starting with the commander in chief. Sam Faddis, as always, we appreciate your clarity and your courage and your hard work on all of these fronts at Ed Magazine and elsewhere, including here. Come back to us soon if you would. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Night after night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome for the first time to a man that I've come to know a little bit and am extraordinarily excited about both having him on this program, of course, but also about the work that he is doing with an organization that I've come to admire tremendously, and that would be Turning Point USA, better known in some circles now as TP USA. His name is Jason Rotundi, and he is these days the Northeast Regional Manager for this organization, which is building out at breathtaking speed, praise God, a network of organizations on college campuses and now in high schools as well, aimed at bringing to bear the vision of its founder, a marvelous individual, well known to the Real America's Voice audience especially, but I think to most of us sentient beings, and that would be Charlie Kirk. Charlie is a friend as well as a very, very much admired colleague. And Jason, I'm so excited. We're going to be doing some work together as it happens, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But first of all, I understand you're a Virginia Tech graduate who got involved in Turning Point USA during your time as a student, and you've now had experience both in the swamp, as they say, as well as now in the Northeast regional role. But tell us first, for level setting purposes, a little bit about Charlie's vision and TP USA and the work that you personally are about on its behalf.
Of course. So Turning Point USA was born through Charlie's, his vision that the youth need to get involved in politics, and that when you want to talk about partisan issues, which our Turning Point Action, our partisan brother, works with, elections are not solely won with the demographic that's 40 and up, 50 and up, but you need to get your brand new voters, your 18-year-olds on campus, your 20-year-olds that are getting ready to graduate. He likes to say that that's how Obama won. He got the youth involved, and the conservative movement never had that. So Turning Point USA is the unique one that focuses primarily on identifying student activists, people that are young and passionate about politics, and helping them become figureheads in the political movement, and in a way recruit others that are also interested or also see the importance of politics, and help getting them involved to really help start the culture war on campus, and not let these leftist institutions indoctrinate all of our students without any pushback.
And, you know, I think the absence of somebody like Charlie and an organization like Turning Point USA probably accounts for much of the difficulty that our country is in at the moment, because we've had, well, probably two generations, I would guess now, that have been inculcated with essentially that leftist indoctrination of which you speak. And they have drunk the Kool-Aid, and they are now voting for, essentially, I think, the takedown of our country, incrementally maybe, but stealthily in some cases, but inexorably by sort of what I've come to describe as the Obama-Biden third term, most especially having had two previous terms to sort of set the predicate for this kind of takedown, fundamental transformation. So when you're on campuses and you're clearly confronting a cohort of leftists who are now, you know, maybe the third generation of their progenitors, what's the most effective technique that you think TPUSA has come up with to both inculcate a love for our country, for freedom, for limited government, for free markets, and so on, in the face of cancellation and silencing and other forms of intimidation?
Yeah, I'd like to preface this answer with clarifying that what I do in my department with Turning Point, we are a 501c3. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan, and so we're never on campus promoting candidates for their candidacy or promoting anybody that is serving in a public role.
This is about policy, not politics.
Right. And then I'd also like to preface with saying that the department is very event-focused. And so the best way to answer your question would be in the field, we focus on ideas and values and things that we know to be true no matter what individual is promoting them. And then what we do is we find individuals that agree and align with those values, and we bring them to campus and allow those who oppose to be the first ones in line to ask questions, to sit in the front and be able to interact with these individuals, because we truly believe that most of these people that are misguided on campus, they're that way because they haven't had the ability to interact and ask questions of those who might be policymakers or those who may be congressmen or women senators who are actually they're actually serving in the highest capacity. And then these people on campus, these students, they just see headlines. They just see things that the leftist news will put out. And then they don't actually get the opportunity to interact with these individuals and figure out that they're not terrible human beings, that it's politics. And so that's the main way that we interact with students, and we see the most benefit coming out.
Well, it's presumably made all the more challenging because, in addition to that sort of groupthink that has been so assiduously inculcated on so many campuses for so long, the professoriate is part of the sort of enforcement mechanism. So, I mean, I just can't tell you how much I admire what you're doing to give exposure to these alternative ideas and create, you know, a sort of countervailing group that is able to offer alternatives and has the courage, even, I guess, at the risk of getting bad grades, of advancing ideas that, the campus and the population on it in the professoriate as well as in the student body needs to hear.
Yeah, and on that point, I actually want to quickly allude to a time when I was in college. I was a sophomore or junior at Virginia Tech, and I was taking a class on immigration, I believe. And I had written a paper for my final about illegal immigration. Now, albeit I was maybe not the most knowledgeable back then, but that's the point of school. And my professor gave me a very poor grade and didn't give any sort of critique on the paper besides saying that writing about illegal immigration in and of itself is dehumanizing and I should never speak of it again. So I took it to the dean and ended up getting my grade fixed, but nothing happened to the professor. And so that's the kind of thing that we're battling on these campuses. And a lot of people that do get involved with Turning Point on campus, it's because they do share a similar story. They were in some way ridiculed or they were given a poor grade at a place where they're paying money to be graded poorly. And they realize that this isn't right. And so they get involved with Turning Point.
Generally, as I come to regard it, both from my own experience putting kids through school and watching what's happening with college tuitions, you're paying a fabulous price to be miseducated, in fact, at the moment. And let me just say, an indication of the kind of impact that Turning Point USA is having in the educational system. I saw a couple of weeks ago, a poll that indicated that particularly young men of college age and thereabouts, maybe a little older, are turning out to be very conservative. And I've got to believe that that's because they have been successfully exposed to the kind of information that you're making available and giving people the sort of, not just the courage of their convictions, but a support group that prevents them from being, picked off as an isolated example. Hats off to what you personally, Jason, are doing in the northeast of the United States, which last time I checked is a hotbed of the left's, sort of dominance on campus. And just a quick word about what Turning Point is also doing now at the high school level as well.
Yeah, actually, what you were just speaking about, I need to tout our high school department because the particular article that I'm familiar with, it specified that graduating high school boys are coming out to be more conservative. And it's not a coincidence that that was written a year after our high school department became its own sole body and focused on school boards and community events, bringing these students out and seeing what the real world could be like. And I think more important than just politics itself, the high school department is also helping prepare young men and women to be adults, whether they go to college or not. We need to be helping these 18-year-olds, 17-year-olds, we need to help them get ready for life. And our high school department, although I am not working in it, I see the work that they're doing. And it's truly amazing. It's inspiring. And as a college employee, it only makes me happier because I know that we have these students coming to college that are already familiar with Turning Point. And when I see that they were a Turning Point president in high school, I know for a fact that that's somebody that I want on my team. So really, hats off to them.
Terrific. Well, hats off to the whole enterprise, really. And we'll be talking about China in the Northeast with your help, Jason, in the months to come. And I couldn't be more excited to do it because, as I say, I think this is the single most important organization in America today for the work that you're doing and what results you're actually able now to increasingly point to, both at the college level and, as you say, the high school. Come back to us with updates, my friend. It's the beginning of an important friendship and conversation. I look forward to many, many further ones in the future. God bless you.
Of course. Thank you very much.
We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. as the Chinese Communist Party's friends in the Biden administration and on Wall Street mount a stealthy campaign to prop up that mortal enemy, a formidable opponent has emerged in Congress. Fortunately, Representative Mike Gallagher can do more than simply raise an alarm about this covert effort to stave off, with U.S. taxpayers and investors' funds, China's intensifying economic crisis and the political one it is precipitating. As chairman of the House Select Committee on the CCP, he can help stop it. In a powerful interview last week, he declared, quote, "Reasonable people can disagree about where exactly you draw the line for economic decoupling from China, but no one, Republican or Democrat, would think that we should be allowing American money to invest in its most dangerous companies. In some meaningful and very troubling sense, we are subsidizing our own destruction," unquote. Amen. This is Frank Affney. We're back. And when I get to say we're back and joined by Robert Spencer, it is a red letter day for me here at Securing America, and I hope for you as well. Robert is, of course, the driving force behind a tremendously important online resource, jihadwatch.org. He is the author of literally 24 books, including most recently The Sumter Gambit, which he talks about how the left is trying to provoke a civil war again. We're going to talk with him a little bit about that in a moment. But Robert, before we get to that, I did want to say, first of all, of course, welcome once again as a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy and a revered colleague. You are always welcome, and especially today. And I wanted to begin by talking about a really thoughtful, I mean, characteristically, but really thoughtful piece that you've written about what Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey is doing to try to essentially achieve the submission of the NATO alliance to one of Sharia's tenets, which is that nobody can offend Frank, its practitioners.
There's been a rash of Quran desecrations and burnings in Denmark and Sweden over the last few months. Many of them, it's noteworthy to say, have been carried out by a couple of Iraqi refugees in Sweden, who have spoken about how much they suffered living with people who understood the Quran's instructions to wage war against and subjugate unbelievers and so on. They were desecrating the Quran not out of racism or hatred or Islamophobia or some kind of an anti-Muslim impulse, but because they were firsthand victims of jihadis. And this has been completely glossed over, of course, in the coverage, which has it all having to do with some kind of irrational hatred. Erdogan has made the application of Sweden to enter NATO contingent upon its banning the burning and desecration of the Quran, which would essentially mean that in order to join NATO, Sweden has to abandon the freedom of expression and adopt what are essentially Islamic blasphemy laws.
So I had thought that at the recent NATO summit, Erdogan, with much fanfare, had withdrawn his objections to having Sweden enter NATO, and that, you know, they had found some kind of modus vivendi, as they say, with respect to Sweden's purported support for Kurdish terrorists that Erdogan found unacceptable. But you're saying that now, having done that, he's added another precondition, and that that precondition has to go to the fundamentals of, well, the Western tradition, certainly, and the best of the Western traditions, freedom of expression.
Yeah, absolutely, Frank. What happened was he did indeed agree, and it seemed as if the whole problem had passed, but the ban on Quran desecration was always something he was insisting on. And it seemed as if he was willing to go along if the Swedes quietly prevented any further incidents from occurring. But instead, they several times at the highest levels acknowledged, well, you know, we don't like this, but Sweden has the freedom of expression, and so we have to allow it. And as the incidents continued, and Sawan Momika, one of the Iraqi refugees, has applied, you have to apply to have a public demonstration in Sweden. And he's now submitted a number of new applications to do it more. And I think that was where Erdogan thought, no, they have to outlaw this. They have to submit.
I see. So Sweden has now, I gather, found one of its neighbors, one of its partners in NATO, Denmark, doing precisely what Erdogan wanted. You've warned in this piece, Robert, that there will be more nations of NATO, presumably following suit as well. And just talk a little bit about what that translates into in terms of, well, what's called submission to Islam.
Frank, the left is no friend of the freedom of expression, and that's why when Denmark announced just today that it was going to ban the burning of the Quran, it's clear that the other Western nations are going to follow through because they want to restrict the freedom of expression as well, and they can use this as a pretext. But from the Islamic standpoint, yes, as you said, it's all about submission, that Islam forbids criticism of the Quran or Muhammad or Allah. And they want the West to abandon the freedom of expression and outlaw that kind of criticism. And the whole idea is to get the West to start accepting aspects of Sharia until ultimately, piece by piece, it's accepted the whole thing. And we're well on the way.
Or at least submitted to it. And yes. This, as you've documented in countless books, is a well-established tradition under Islam that you can become a second-class citizen. You don't have to convert to Islam, but you have to become a dhimmi, as they say.
That's the idea.
And this seems to be what's afoot. And I guess, Robert, the thing that I've prized about our relationship, what you've taught me over the years, what you've written about so brilliantly, so often, is how this is responded to by Muslims, Sharia supremacists, I call them, like Recep Tayyip Erdogan, for example. Is that the end of the matter, or does an expression, a demonstration of submission generally lead to worse?
Well, this is the problem, Frank, that now Denmark is setting the precedent that, yes, terrorism works. Violent intimidation works. You threaten us, and we will submit. The lesson for Recep Tayyip Erdogan and all the rest of them is all you have to do is threaten us more to get us to do what you want. And so there's going to be plenty more threats instead of fewer.
Yeah, and tragically, this isn't just, you know, sort of an individual response. This is what they're supposed to respond to submission with, is it not? Robert, we have to take a short break. We're going to be right back with more on the other side of it. Please stay tuned. We're back, and we're visiting with one of my favorite people. His name is Robert Spencer, an extraordinarily prolific, author, but essayist as well, a man who has made such an incredible contribution to our understanding of a topic that most people have been, well, not only ill-equipped, but too terrified to even address, let alone address so thoughtfully, and I think with such utter validation of their thoughts. Robert Spencer, thank you for staying with us. And I wanted to say that one of the things that you've done with jihadwatch.org is address the red part of what we've come to call the red-green axis, in addition to the green, the Islamist elements that you cover so well. And it caught my eye that you have prominently featured at the moment on jihadwatch.org an interview that you did with a mutual friend of ours, Dr. Bob, as he calls himself. His show is entitled Life Lessons with Dr. Bob Shulman, and he is a serious, I think, intellectual force in his own right. But I was very gratified to see that he gave you a platform to talk a bit about, the life lessons of dealing with the radical left and its efforts to take down not just our culture, but really our society, the fundamental transformation of America, as Barack Obama famously called it. Give us a sort of highlights of your conversation with Dr. Bob.
Yeah, it was fascinating to discuss it all with him, Frank, and he was very concerned about the left's authoritarian and totalitarian impulses, which are increasingly evident. The left does not believe in free inquiry or in loyal dissent in disagreement, and they are moving now to crush dissent and essentially criminalize opposition in the United States. And this is what we discussed, Dr. Bob and I, in light of a book I wrote about this, The Sumter Gambit, How the Left is Trying to Foment a Civil War, showing that the Biden administration is not an administration like other American administrations, but in the arrest of Trump, the multiple arrests now of Trump, the arrests of other people, like the people in the so-called the trumped up, as it were, January 6th insurrection and so many others, the Biden administration is showing itself to be the real enemy of the democracy it's claiming to protect. And the implications of that are extraordinarily disquieting.
Yeah. You know, a couple of things, Bob, Robert, that I think are worth teasing out of that is, one is I think one of the things that is important to tease out of that particular thought, Robert, is that actually this is like another administration or two, Obama Biden 1.0 and Obama Biden 2.0. We're now in Obama Biden 3.0, as I see it. It's just that they've taken all of this to sort of the logical extremes of where the first two of these administrations wanted it to go. And we talked a little bit earlier in the program with our friend Charles Sam Faddis about this prospect of civil war. As you know, Tucker Carlson, in his conversation with Donald Trump the other day, asked him pointedly twice, do you think there will be a civil war? And, I think he kind of deflected the question, but your book makes perfectly clear that that is where they want it to go. And what I was asking Sam about, and be very interested in your thoughts, Robert, is are they in fact provoking the right, American patriots, MAGA, normal citizens of our country, into acting violently to try to stop this fundamental transformation that is taking place before our eyes, and to the great expense of, well, basically, I think everything we hold dear. I'm not recommending that, of course, nor are you, nor do we want to see that happen. But is that, in your estimation, what's afoot at the moment at the hands of the Biden 3.0 team?
Absolutely. In the Sumter Gambit book, actually, that's one of the primary points that I make, that the left's trying to set up a win-win situation for itself. Either we sit back and let them implement their insane, life-destroying agenda and take away all our freedoms, or they hope by the arrests of Trump and everything else to ultimately provoke us into a response that they can use to say, see, see, they really are insurrectionists. They really are enemies of democracy. And this justifies our authoritarian crackdown. And so they think either way they get their authoritarian regime, whether by crushing a revolt or by instilling a passivity in us that allows them just to roll over us. We have to play smarter than that and resist in all kinds of ways that they cannot exploit to their own advantage.
Resist now, to the point. And Robert, I talked a little bit about this with Sam as well. I'd be interested in your thoughts. My concern in part about the nomination of C.Q. Brown, the current chief of staff of the Air Force, is that this general, if in fact confirmed by the United States Senate next month to become the next chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a man imbued, it appears, with this, you know, cultural Marxist agenda. And we've seen over the past three or so years of his service as the Air Force chief, his willingness to impose it on his service, and presumably he will do even more of that if the top military officer. We're out of time for you to respond to this, but I just wanted to say I fear that the military may be in the process of being weaponized for the purpose of effecting the kind of crackdown that you've just warned of, and you've done so well in your book, The Sumter Gambit. Thank you for coming, my friend. Forgive me for denying you the opportunity to respond, but we're hard out of time. We'll do it the next time, and I hope that will be soon. God bless you. I hope the rest of you will be joining us next time. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Go forth and multiply.